Good morning. We are back with the All About Us podcast, Africa in Diaspora. Here we talk about Africa and Africans all over the world and indigenous populations everywhere, whom I consider our brothers and sisters. We talk about our cultures, beliefs, customs, religion, politics, and world situations impacting all of us. Hopefully, by exploring these topics and issues, we find a way to connect and bring us together. I would like to welcome everyone today. This is a very special broadcast here. This guest today is one of my longest lifelong friends. Our friendship is coming up on 45 years. He spent many years in the music industry. He's currently a film director. And as stated, he has an incredible project right now that he's working on. I would like to introduce everyone to Benjamin Jemison Phillips. How are you doing today, Ben?
I'm doing excellent, Carl. Definitely a pleasure to be on with you this morning.
So Ben, it's been a long time coming. As stated, we've had a friendship for 35 years now. I'd like to start with your background in church and in the Lord, because when I first met you, I didn't even know anything about your religious background. I didn't know that your father was one of the great bishops of Church of God in Christ. And I don't think you knew that I was licensed and ordained Church of God in Christ. We were both so caught up that time in the music industry. That was something that really didn't come out until maybe a year or two after we had met and we shared some personal things with you. But I'd never shared with you at that time that I was licensed and ordained Church of God in Christ. I'd like for you to share some of your background concerning your mother, her in the choir, the Church of God in Christ, and just how that impacted your life, your birth, and some of your history in that.
Absolutely. Love to. I was born in Memphis, Tennessee, the son of Jesse Jemison Phillips, who at that time was a very prominent gospel recording artist and a singer, songwriter, and book author. My father was James Oglethorpe Patterson, or Bishop J.O. Patterson, who was a bishop there in Memphis at the time, but went on to become the presiding bishop of the Church of God in Christ, actually the longest serving presiding bishop of the church in the history of the organization. He was a presiding bishop for 21 years. And for those of you who don't understand the structure of the Church of God in Christ, the presiding bishop would be the equivalent of the Pope for the Catholic Church.
Correct.
Yeah, he actually had married the daughter of the founder of the Church of God in Christ organization, Bishop C.H. Mason's daughter, Deborah. And that was pretty much how he got in a position that allowed him to step up after Bishop Mason's death to become the leader of the organization. My mom, like I said, she was a gospel recording artist. She was a part of a vocal group called the Pentecostal Ensemble, which my father's church, Pentecostal Temple, was actually named after the group. They were very popular during that era. They started in the early 50s and went on toward, actually, I think the last member of the ensemble died just a couple of years ago. But they were very prominent. They flew all over the country, toured all over the country. I remember about 3 or 4 years old sitting on the sidelines in Memphis while they taped a television show. So I grew up in that environment of both religion and music. And it's been a lifelong love.
Great. What do you remember about your early childhood? What were some of the things that impacted you during that period? And for a while, you stayed in Memphis, but then where did your family go to after that?
From Memphis to Arkansas, then briefly lived in Ohio for a little bit, lived in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Chicago, and then eventually migrated to Albuquerque and then California, which is where we met in California, I believe. It was around 1980, I'd like to say six.
Yeah, it was in that 86 to 87 time frame that me and you and I actually met. You and I met Rudy Dean on C.W. Dean's Record City on the south side of San Diego. I had a record label, and I often interfaced with Rudy Dean to find local talent. He was like a father figure to me, and he introduced us. Our meeting and our friendship is a direct reflection of his love for both of us and wanting us to meet. And so I'd like for you to share what you know about Rudy, because your relationship was actually started with him prior to mine. So tell our guest what you knew of Rudy Dean.
Rudy Dean was a phenomenal individual. I think at the time that I got to know him, he had been in business there in San Diego at the same location for about 17 years, a record shop serving the community. He was, for those in the Black community, to give you an idea, he was like the neighborhood barbershop.
Correct.
Everybody congregated there, wanted to come by and chit-chat with Rudy, kick politics and religion and what's going on in the music industry and the entertainment world. He was just an all-around good guy. Everyone loved him. The community loved him. And he had a keen ability to look at people and see their potential and pick out people that he felt had seeds of greatness in them, and network them together so they could help one another to grow. And that's what I believe he saw between you and I. It wasn't just an issue of we both working or having exposure in the music industry, because I was active in the industry at that time, and you had your own label. As a matter of fact, your record label, Adept Records, was the inspiration behind me developing my company, my film company, Adept Films.
Correct.
Because I thought that name was so unique in that what it represented, that the true meaning of the word adept. And that was what I aspired for in movie making. I know that's fast forwarding, because at that time I was working with the Barkays and dealing with music.
Right.
But eventually that evolved to management of celebrities, and then beyond that, producing and directing motion pictures and television.
Correct. When I first met you, I was introduced to you as you were a road manager with the Barkays. You worked with the Barkays, and that was one of my favorite groups in the late 70s.
The technicality was that I really wasn't a road manager. I was more involved with the publicity for the Barkays. And then eventually I did my own record, which most people don't know, but several members of the Barkays were actually the musicians for my band.
Wow.
It was one of those kind of studio situations where the entity and the group was created in the studio.
Correct.
And just like with Prince and The Time, the first Time album, pretty much everything that was played on it was Prince.
Prince, correct.
And later he hired band members to learn the songs and become The Time.
Correct.
Well, that's pretty much the way it was with my group, Captain Fantastic and Starfleet. It was me and the Barkays went in the studio, recorded the songs. I found someone that I liked as a lead vocalist, put him in the group, and basically after that, we got musicians to actually learn the songs. But the record was really the Barkays.
See, that was something I didn't even know. So that was something.
Yeah, absolutely. It was the Barkays. And as a matter of fact, if you had one of those original 45s, the address for the record label was actually the home address of Charles Allen, who was known as Scoop. He was the trumpet player in the Barkays.
Wow.
And he produced actually that first record.
Okay.
And it's ironic, Carl, that when that record came out, it was independent. and it was only 1,000 copies of it. We sold a few copies. Rudy had quite a few at his record shop.
Okay.
But I recall there was one time we went to Lexington, Kentucky for a promotional party to promote the record. And at this promotional party, we were signing autographed copies of the record. I remember there was one individual I offered a copy of the record to, and they said that was okay.
Wow.
I couldn't even give a copy of the record away. And here we are, fast forward. Last year, our record company in Los Angeles asked to re-release it, and I signed a deal with them for a re-release, which has turned out to be a cult type of following behind this song. I didn't even know that. The reason they wanted to re-release it is because it's so popular over in Europe that copies of the 45 are selling for $850 a copy.
Wow.
And that's a record I couldn't give away when I first put it out.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
It's wild.
It's the same thing happened to me because I got disillusioned with the music industry at one point, moved up to LA, started going to UCLA, and then eventually to medical school. But at one point when I was in UCLA, I got invited out to an event, and there were a bunch of industry people there. And they said, yeah, this is good. This is Carl Allen. This is the Adept from Adept Records. And Rudy, Ben, it was just like jaw-dropping because everybody stopped and looked at me and said, you're that guy from that record label in San Diego?
Wow.
And I didn't know how to respond because I didn't know what they were getting at. They said, man, everybody wondered what happened to you. They said, we knew that if you hung around, you were going to be the next up and coming producer. What happened to you? And I just had to tell them, I gave up.
Part of that, too, I'm sure goes back to Anthony Williams, a.k.a. Tone, a.k.a. B. Slade.
Right. You did
his first demo.
Right. You brought him. You brought Tone. You said, Carl, I have to bring Tone to your studio in LA. I said, who's Tone? I said, he's a 7, 8 year old. I said, Ben is 7, 8, 9 years old. What can he do? I said, but you were my friend. I said, bring him on. We took him back into the studio. You said, just show him how all of this equipment. Showed him how all the equipment worked. I come back out into my living room to sit down and talk with you. We're talking for 10 minutes. I turn my head and I'm like, this kid is wrecking my equipment harder than I can myself. My jaw just dropped. And I knew he was destined to be.
Yeah, he's an absolute genius.
A superstar.
And he's a genius.
Go ahead. I'm going to let you continue. It hurt my heart that
he's been ostracized by the church because of his lifestyle choice. I feel really bad about that because this young man has so much that he has to give and has given and continues to give. He hasn't lost one step in his creativity because he's been ostracized, but it definitely has impacted his career. And I hate that because I love him with a passion. He's like my little brother. I was his first manager in the music industry. I knew his mother and his father, and they trusted me to help guide his career. And he's just incredibly talented. And I know where he could be. Literally, he had an opportunity to be signed with Prince when Prince was living.
Correct.
I gave a copy of his demo. As a matter of fact, some of the songs that you produced, I gave a copy of that demo
to Prince.
To Denise Matthews,
right,
who was known as Vanity, one of Prince's first female recording artists.
Correct.
And a lot of people remember from the group Vanity Six. So I gave a copy of the demo to her. She heard it. She was blown away. And she reached out to Prince. And literally, Prince was ready to give him a deal. He got back to me. He wanted to give the kid a deal. And Tone did not want to accept it because he only wanted to do gospel music. That's how intense his commitment was
at that time
to gospel. Yes.
Now, I probably never shared this with you. Do you know how he got his first record deal, actually?
I heard that part of that involved you with
Alicia Gwynn.
With Tony Gwynn. Yeah, Tony Gwynn's wife. And here's the crazy part, and it just goes to show you how God works. The same time you were dealing with the Gwynns concerning Tony, I was dealing with Wayne Williams, who was the vice president of Jive Records. He was the brother of my roommate, Jesse Saunders. And I was dealing with Wayne on listening to this kid's demo. I've been bugging him for almost 6 months to listen to this kid's demo. He wouldn't do it. And finally, he did it. And he's, man, who is this guy? And at the same time, you were dealing with the Gwynns, and they were hitting him up for the same thing.
Here's what happened on my end. I was in my second year of medical school. Alicia Gwynn, first of all, TLC was in financial trouble and wouldn't re-sign with their label. Left Eye's cousin, Tangi, is from Philadelphia. I get in contact with Tangi because Alicia Gwynn wants to sign TLC. Tony Gwynn gave her the go ahead to give them a multi-million dollar contract. In the interim, what happened was Left Eye said, okay, we will meet with you, but in order for you to show me that you're serious, you have to send my cousin Tangi $1,000. I got on the phone with Alicia Gwynn. Alicia Gwynn sent Tangi $1,000. I don't want to call them names. Anyways, they had purchased me a ticket, but I was busy. And they were trying to call me all day telling me that I had to get on a plane flight. I had to get on a plane flight because they had actually scheduled the meeting for the next day. I was still in medical school. I didn't get the call. I didn't get the call right away. And so I didn't get a call to the next day. They tried to close the deal without me being there and basically blew the deal. So I get out there 2 days later. I'm trying to put this thing back together where Alicia Gwynn would actually sign TLC and I would have Tone do a lot of the music for their group for their next album and with me producing it. I went and sent Tone into the studio. Tone used his money. I was supposed to be the president of her label. What in turn happened, the legal guy, I can't remember his name right now. It escapes me. He convinced Alicia Gwynn to fire me, give me 2 months' salary, but they wanted Tone's tape. I should have never given them Tone's tape. But they were cutting off he convinced her to cut me off, give me 2 months' salary, and give me a plane ticket back home. I went ahead, I turned over the music that was supposed to be for TLC that Tone did. He turns around, tells Tone that, well, we paid him. And he was supposed to pay for your studio sessions, and he never paid for your studio sessions. No, I told them that Tony had an ongoing debt. They said, you know what? She's going another direction as far as the president of her label now. And so we're going to terminate our agreement with you, give you severance pay and a plane ticket back to Philadelphia. Unless in 3 weeks after he got Tone's demo tape, he left.
I didn't hear that last part. You faded out.
Less than 3 weeks after he got Tone's demo tape, He quit his position with Alicia Gwynn and took that demo to New York City and got Tone's record deal. The demo. Wow. I did.
Wow. Off your demo. So he took it there to Wayne and got him a deal. That is crazy.
Gospel deal. That's how that all, just so much just craziness just happens,
you know,
in the music business.
Because that stands to reason. It actually fits some pieces of the puzzle together, because the album, the first album that he did with them was H2O.
H2O, yeah.
And what was TLC's last hit? Waterfall. Yeah, it's something else that was crazy with regard to Tone. And like I said, he's B. Slade now, but he's still destined for greatness. He hasn't even seen the tip of the iceberg yet.
But he missed a big window. But then, once again, I had another interaction with him when I was at Philly Style Records. He came to Philadelphia, and I said, Tone, I said, a lot of the people you're surrounded by don't seem right. And he said, what do you mean don't seem right? I said, Tone, your manager and the people around him seem a little effeminate. He says, what makes you say that? I said, they're talking about hair, attire, and using the term natural woman. And he was just Carl Dallas. He said, you're just a little paranoid. You're just a little paranoid. He couldn't see that I seen the seeds of what Satan was creeping in and bringing in to destroy him. And I tried to warn him. I tried to warn him about that manager he had. And I just could not get in. This had to be 1999.
Well, I would think, Carl, to be very frank, that no manager influenced his lifestyle choice. That's a misconception. As a matter of fact, I have some insight.
But you probably
a certain level of insight that it wasn't anything like that.
Once again,
sometimes things happen to people
right
in the course of their life that they have no control over.
Okay,
and it makes an imprint. I'm not gonna go into that
right,
because that's his story.
Right,
and when he's ready, or if he's ready to ever tell his story, he will do so himself.
Correct.
Like I said, I love Tone.
I do too.
He is like, at this point, with his parents being gone, he's like a son as far as I'm concerned. And I will always have the highest esteem and the highest respect for him and the greatest love for his talent, his gift, and him as a human being. That was the same kind of situation that evolved with Bishop Carlton Pearson, who came out of the Church of God in Christ. He was a very popular bishop, primarily responsible for Bishop T.D. Jakes
right
becoming known on a national level, because he had Bishop Jakes speak at his ZUSA meeting in, I think it was Tulsa, Oklahoma City. Yeah, and after that, Bishop Jakes blew up and became a household name. But people left association with Carlton Pearson when he adapted this new philosophy of inclusion with his church, which was to open up his church to the homosexual community and taking a stance that there was no such thing as hell. And that was the line that was crossed as far as most conventional Christians are concerned. And I got to say, for me, to say that there's no hell, that to me is a total contradictory of what I've come to know.
Correct.
The scriptures to state from the very beginning, the wages of sin are death.
Correct.
And the consequences of disobedience is the lake of fire. I will never bend my stance and my belief on the scriptures verbatim. I don't deviate from that. But I'm not his judge or his peer in that regard to cast judgment on him. As a matter of fact, the Bible makes it clear that if an individual is a servant or claims to be a servant of God, who is another man to judge God's servant. True. So that's something that has to be dealt with between God and him, not me and him or me in the court of public opinion.
Absolutely. You know? But yeah, it was just
speak on his talent. And
correct.
He is phenomenally talented. He's worked with so many people, Chaka Khan, Jackie Clark Chisholm from the Clark Sisters.
Right.
And it's just, oh man, just I'd be lost for words to really try and go down all of them. Shawnee, what's the daughter of, oh God, I can't.
Donny Hathaway.
Layla Hathaway, and so many others.
He is,
the kid is just, he's out the box.
Yeah.
He's incredible.
He is clearly the most talented individual that I directly interfaced with up to date. He's just, as far as you're talking, writing, singing, musician, basic producing.
Yeah, musician, producer, engineer, writer.
He's basically another Prince.
And songwriter, a prolific songwriter. He is exactly that. I was about to say that he and Prince are the two individuals that I place in the highest category with regard to that. I've known Prince since 1982. I met him first in 1982. And it wasn't a buddy relationship or
correct,
something like that. Years would go by before I'd have contact with him again. But after I started representing Denise as her road manager, Vanity, then my contact became a little bit more frequent with him. But
right,
without question, Tony and Prince, pretty much on the same level with regard to creativity.
Same level.
Tony doesn't have the, or B. Slade doesn't have the popularity that Prince did, and certainly hasn't sold as many records or have the wealth that Prince did. But creatively, he's on that level.
Correct. Correct. Clearly the most talented person I've ever touched, worked with, been in my studio, been in the studio with. He's just phenomenal. He's just phenomenal. Currently, let's delve into, how did you transition from the music business into the film business? Because this is something that I'm not even really sure about. I got some calls and I said, Ben's a film director. He got his own film company now and he's calling it Adept Films. Aren't you mad? I said, that's my buddy. I said, he always shared with me his fascination with Adept, what it means. Where did I get the name from? And it was from a series of books called the Apprentice Adept series. And I said, I took time to explain that to him. We had detailed conversations. I used to tell people, I'm not surprised that I have Adept Records and he has Adept Films. I said, it's...
Yeah, and I actually saw that as a compliment because I had hoped that we would come together and do some joint projects.
Exactly.
Where Adept Films would make some movies and Adept Music and Records would be the soundtrack.
Correct.
Yeah, but it was a serious music commitment. We actually even produced a record together on one of your artists. Yeah. You blessed me. Yes, Reve, you allowed me to be a part of that project. You did the project, but you blessed me with a credit in there and allowed me to have some creative input.
Well, let's be honest, Ben, you set up the studio, which we basically lived in for over a week recording that album.
Yeah, yeah.
So you set that up for me in Los Angeles. We came up to Los Angeles, camped out for about 10 days in that recording studio to record the album. And then you brung the cat in. I can't remember his name, who did the vocoder part on the song.
Troy. Yes, Troy. I don't remember Troy's last name.
It's been so long, Ben.
I have a copy of the album around here, so I gave him credit.
And what was so amazing with that particular song was I accidentally erased the entire sequence. And wow. I had to sit down and everybody said, what are you going to do? You erased
it. I remember that.
I said, I wrote it. I can rewrite it. I sat down there and within 3 hours had that thing reconstructed. And I remember you saying, the second one's better than the first one to me.
The first one, it was, absolutely.
I said, I don't think absolutely. So, Ben. But that was your take on it. But we have...
Hey, here's the crazy part. The song that we did, Undercover Lover, that's the song that's selling for $850 a copy over in Europe.
Oh, my goodness.
That single, my original single from 1984 that I could not give away in 1984, is literally selling for $850 a copy in Europe right now. The average price of it is $850.
That's amazing.
And one person was advertising that they had 16 copies available.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah, it really is. Someone else that we work together with is Kimmy Kim.
Kimmy Kim.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Kimberly Cummings Martinez.
Yep. Kimmy Kim. So we had it, and there was the other group that you were managing, which I did a couple tracks for from Florida, I believe. You sent some of my music in there, but they had already had their album compiled. So the all girls expose, the girl
expose,
all girls.
Yes. I wasn't managing the entire group. One of the members of the group,
correct,
the lead vocalist.
Yeah,
that
was a hard sell. That was a hard sell anyways, because their producer, he didn't want to give up anything. That's where his money came from.
Absolutely.
Producing and writing.
Sylvia Riera, who was co-manager for that particular individual with Exposé, she turned me on to a group over in Germany that she's like, Ben, they want me to manage them. I can't do it because I'm having problems already with Exposé. And
right.
I told them about you, and they said, yes, they would like to sign to you. So would you talk with them and see where this goes? And I got on the phone and tried to have a conversation with these guys a couple of days later. We briefly talked on the phone, but they had very, very poor
English,
very few words in English, and didn't have an interpreter available at the time, and neither did I. And that group ended up having a mega hit. It was already a hit song.
Wow.
But it hadn't really blown up to its full potential. But it was Milli Vanilli.
Milli Vanilli. There's so many different things that came by. In fact, when we took Reve to LA, he had a record deal with Motown. He had a record deal with Motown. They invited us to the Christmas party. Guess who took our record deal? We were supposed to sign our recording contract. We were supposed to sign our recording contract January 7th of 1989. Guess who they ended up giving our recording contract to?
Who?
Michael Bivins, Boys to Men.
Oh, wow.
That's who stole Reve's contract.
But I think I heard something about that.
They stole our recording
and
contract.
As matter of fact, going back to it, Michael Bivins and what's the other guy's name? Oh, I can't think of the other one. They were in the studio when I went to pick up the final mix of Kimmy Kim's song Playmate. Yep. They were in the same studio that I recorded her at.
They stole our record deal. We came there.
That's crazy.
Came back up there to sign all the paperwork and everything. Had us waiting hours outside, and then came out and said, "We have bad news for you. We decided not to sign Reve, and we gave his contract to a group out of Philadelphia called Boys to Men. Michael Bivins is representing him."
Yeah, that's wild, man.
It's a lot of people. And once again, years later, they said you should have never stopped. They said you were right there. They said you were like next. I said, yeah, but I just got burnt out. I got burnt out on all the disappointment. But that's enough about me. Let's go back to you. How did you transfer?
Yeah, that's kind of the same thing. I got tired, fed up with the music, a little disillusioned. So I gravitated toward focusing more on managing artists with potential so they didn't go through some of the frustrations that I had gone through trying to develop a career as a recording artist. And I was fortunate in that there in San Diego, I was an extended part of the family of Bishop George D. McKinney, and he accepted me as Him and his wife, Jean McKinney, accepted me as a part of their family, considered me one of their sons. And his boys, basically, they looked at me as a brother. So I was able and blessed to be a part of them getting an opportunity with someone else who was a part of the Church of God in Christ, Keith and Kenneth Crouch, right, the nephews of the late, great Andre Crouch. And Keith and Ken brought in Glenn McKinney and Greg McKinney to help play on a demo that they were putting together for this new singer who was 14 years old. And that singer ended up being the one and only Brandy. So Keith and Ken produced that first album, I Want to Be Down, Best Friends, all of that stuff, Broken Hearted, all of that was done by the Crouches.
Okay.
And I was blessed to be interjected in that project in terms of a connection to Brandy. And when she came down and did her concert in San Diego, I was able to get to know her mother better. And it played a role in me being able to get a lot of publicity work for her and with and through her mother. And that opened up doors with other artists. And, you know, it just progressed on and on. It helped strengthen me in a managerial position. And by then, I was also doing casting for a lot of music videos in LA.
Okay.
And that opened up the door for the film thing. I was providing talent for a lot of the music videos, pretty much every video that Jay-Z made up until he retired as a recording artist. I think Girls was the last video that he did in that era and that I was a part of. But all of those music videos, I Just Want to Love You, Izzo, all of them, the girls and talent in those videos came from my company.
I didn't know that.
And a lady by the name of Vanessa Williams. We both provided talent for those videos. 50 Cent in the club, his first hit song.
Amazing.
Probably 75, 80% of the girls in that music video came from my company.
Ben always had all the girls, that's for certain.
I don't know about that. But yeah, that we've done Missy Elliott, Aaliyah. Not her last video, More Than a Woman, which was before the last video, literally provided talent for More Than a Woman, and Aaliyah left the next day to go over to the Bahamas to film Rock the Boat.
Right.
Just some iconic moments. Mystical's Danger video and
correct,
so many others. Yeah. So that opened up the door in the film. And basically, I got a call from one of the members of the Barkays, Larry Johnson. And he's, Ben, listen, I'm down here in Houston, Texas right now. And I'm with a lady that I've known for a while. Her name is Charlie Bellinger. And she wants to promote some concerts. She wants to see if she can get a few dates with some artists. Maybe you could connect her to Genuine or Brandy. And we promote some concerts. And I said, how much does she want to spend? And he put her on the phone and I repeated the question to her. I said, how much are you trying to invest in doing this? And she said, I don't know, maybe $250,000. And I said, that kind of money, you could make a movie. And she said, oh, yeah? I said, yeah, you could make a movie for $250,000, let alone talk about get some concerts. She said, do you know how to do that? And honestly, I never made a movie, but I said, absolutely, I got some credits. Yeah, we can make it happen. I can get you a producer. I can get you a director. I'll come in as a producer, and we can make it happen. And she said, then let's do it. And that was my first decent budget film that I did. I had a couple of films that I had been listed in the credits for before for providing talent and some promotional expertise and things of that nature, various production inserts, but never an active hands-on role up until Charlie Bellinger came along.
And what was the name of that film?
That was the J.R. Richards story.
Okay, that's what I thought.
And I was able to hire or put her in touch to hire Greg Carter to direct the film.
Okay.
We had all of the actors that were principal actors in the film were my friends. I got Bokeem Woodbine originally, who was going to play J.R. Richard, but at the last minute, he bailed out. And in turn, I used an actor by the name of David Ramsey, who was a good friend of mine. He had his own TV show on the UPN network called, I think it was called A Man. No, it wasn't A Man, but it was one of those church shows that was out during the late 80s. I can't even, Good News. Good News was the name of the show. And so I got him to play J.R. Richard. While I was at a restaurant with Bokeem in Hollywood, actually Beverly Hills, Sarah Stokes walked in with her husband, Tony. And at that time, Sarah was a hot property on Puffy's Making the Band show on MTV.
Correct.
So I started talking to Sarah, told her about the show, and told her if she'd be willing to be a part of the movie, that I would not only hire her, but I'd hire her husband to be in the movie too. And she said she loved the idea. So again, I put her in touch with Charlie Bellinger and they made the deal happen. And then I asked Claudia Jordan to play a role, who was a part of Real Housewives of Atlanta at that time. Claudia had a scheduling problem and couldn't be a part, but she asked me if I would consider Kenya Moore from Real Housewives of Atlanta. And that's how Kenya got to be a part of it. And there were so many other individuals who basically came in the same way. So it was a star-studded film that, including Charles Durning, Greg Carter actually bought in. Charles Durning is one of the most distinguished actors that I've ever known. I've met a lot of big-name actors, the Tom Cruises and all of that stuff. But Charles Durning had more history in the industry than anybody I've ever met. He went all the way back to the days of Mae West and Charlie Chaplin when he was a kid as an actor, been in hundreds of movies. And he's a name that most people, you wouldn't put a face with the name if you hear it, but if you see who he is, you'll be like, oh yeah, that's the actor from this film or that film. And just so many. One of the ones that I love so much is a film that came out in the 90s, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Okay.
He played the governor in that film. And like I said, he's done hundreds of films, worked with everything from Mae West and Charlie Chaplin to Al Pacino and Tom Hanks and so many others. And that's how things progressed. And after that film, they just snowballed one after another. The last film that I had some involvement in, actually acted in, is a movie that was made by Tom Hanks, filmed here in New Mexico, where I live. And it was called News of the World. It was Tom Hanks' cowboy movie.
Okay.
And that was a wonderful experience to be on set with him and see how he, you know, interacted with both the principal actors and the background actors. We filmed this thing in the cold of October. As a matter of fact, the last day of filming was Halloween night, and the temperatures were well below zero, well below freezing. And we're out there, and of course, Tom Hanks being an A-list star, he had his own trailer that was heated and his own chef and everything else. But when he saw that the extras and the non-essential actors were out there in the cold, standing in line to get their little ration of food that was dished out. You know how it goes with craft services for food.
Oh, yeah.
Literally, Tom Hanks left out of his trailer, got out there with everybody else, stayed out there in the freezing cold, shivering and hovering around a fire just like everybody else, telling us stories about the films that he had done in the past, cracking jokes with us and giving inspiration to these aspiring actors that were out there trying to get their first big break to be in one of his films as just an extra.
Amazing.
And it was really impressive to see the kind of character that he had and the compassion that he had concerning all of these other actors and how he was willing to get out there and suffer with them rather than be in the comfort of his trailer and wait until it was time for him to come back on the scene. I was actually in that movie. I played a role in that movie. I played Skinner, a Buffalo Skinner in the movie. However, most of my role and all the other roles that were relative to the scene that I was in, which was basically, It was about the Punch Bowl, Mississippi Punch Bowl. I don't know if you know about that, but it's a true story of when the Civil War had ended or was about to end. It hadn't completely ended, but it was about to end, and slaves were being freed in the South. They were passing through the Mississippi Delta, and there was an area down there called the Punch Bowl, Natchez, Mississippi, where a bunch of racist landowners got together, and the newly freed slaves that were trying to go north to freedom, they captured them in that area and had them in a basically concentration camp, this Punch Bowl, this little insert in the ground that they had up to 20,000 newly freed slaves that they were holding there against their will, forcing them to do labor. And if they didn't cooperate, they killed them.
Incredible.
And literally, they did not feed them. They had to live off of whatever they could get, the fruit trees and that kind of thing that was down in there. They worked them. And if one died, they laid where they died unless some of the other slave, newly freed slaves took them and buried them. And to this day, if you go to that area in Natchez, Mississippi, it's now overgrown with trees. And it has peach trees there. And the peaches on the trees are as big as cantaloupes. But nobody will eat them because they know what the fertilizer was that caused them to grow so big. 20,000 black newly freed slaves died in that little Punch Bowl area. And their bodies are the fertilizer for the peach trees that grow.
Amazing. Absolutely crazy instances of what has happened to our people during the course of slavery.
Yeah, that was the section that I was in the movie. It was a reenactment of that. But at the time, George Floyd had just been killed, and it became such a big controversy about what happened with him that the directors decided to edit out that whole scene of that slave town or forced labor town of the newly freed slaves. So if you watch News of the World, you'll see me in there, but just for a split second, because they edited out most of that whole scene.
Incredible.
That whole town, because of what it represented and the climate that was going on at that time, which was highly racially charged because of what had happened with George Floyd.
Correct. That was the impetus for me starting on my nonprofit, actually, Stand Up and Do.
Oh, wow.
That's when that situation, that horror story, that changed the path that I was on and set me in the direction I'm in now. But what I would like to talk about next is this beautiful project for an artist who was my first idol, actually. And I want you to tell my audience about the current film project, the documentary you're working on.
Yeah, it's a pretty intense documentary, and one of the people that I have involved with it is Greg Carter, which I mentioned Greg before, but Greg was the first person. He was a director who, or is a director who, gave me my first credit in the movie industry and has provided me numerous credits along the way, allowed me to participate in some of the projects that he's done, and vice versa. I'm now returning that favor with my current project, which is the documentary on the death of Prince, and it's called 421, A Royal Loss, because Prince died on 421, April 21st, and A Royal Loss is the subtitle of the documentary. I say that to first, before I go into the film, just give honor to Greg, because like I said, he was instrumental in me getting to the point that I am right now, being credited as a producer on Cat Williams' first album and so many other projects because of him. But this movie is an in-depth investigation into Prince's death. Like I said, I knew Prince. I was a road manager for the love of his life and his first major recording artist project aside from himself, which was Vanity and Vanity 6. And when he died on the one-year anniversary of his death, his brother, Omar, decided he was going to make a documentary about the record label that he had just started, which was PRN Family Records, Prince Rogers Nelson Family Records. And so he talked to some of the band members for Prince to find out their thoughts on who should direct the documentary. And a young lady by the name of Marva King, who was very close to Prince, a vocalist in his group, New Power Generation, and actually Prince liked her romantically. Marva stepped up and said, "Hey, what about Ben Jimerson Phillips? He's known Prince. He was road manager for Vanity. And so he's got the history already with the artist. And what about him?" Ultimately, Prince's brother Omar decided to hire me after he'd seen some of my work. It flew me up to Minneapolis. And I was able to spend 2 weeks there filming at Paisley Park, in the studio, outside the studio, on location. And had a phenomenal project that I was very pleased to have both produced and directed for Prince's brother and his family. And while I was there, I just started learning a lot about his death, about Prince's paranoia in using the elevator, how he was a little claustrophobic on that, never used the elevator. Anytime he traveled in Paisley Park, he always took the steps. And the circumstances about his clothing being up and down the hallway leading to the elevator, and just so many things that just did not add up that I learned in the process of being there, that it made me start to question everything that I had heard about his death. And the more we investigated, the more we found out that things were not the way they were being portrayed in the media. And I think part of that stems from the fact that the Chanhassen Sheriff's Department had never handled a high-profile celebrity death before, or investigation. So they made a lot of blunders starting day one, and quite literally, because of their blunders, individuals that I will not name at this point, but you will certainly be able to figure out for yourself when you see the documentary, who in all likelihood provided the fatal dose counterfeit pills, because that's one thing people think, they hear that he died of fentanyl ingestion. He wasn't taking fentanyl pills. Mm-hmm. Prince took a pill that was marked as an OxyContin pain reliever, but that was really counterfeit and was fentanyl. And it put enough fentanyl in his system, I'm told, to have killed 100 men his size. Somebody provided him those counterfeit pills, whether it was a deliberate attempt to kill him or an accidental thing. I won't cast any judgments out there. I'll leave that for the individuals to watch the documentary and decide for themselves. But I'm going to tell you, when you see this documentary and what we've uncovered, you'll end the film with your mouth wide open, because it's nothing like the narrative we've been led to believe. Nothing like that narrative.
One of the things I personally know about Prince is this. He is a very, I don't want to use the word paranoid, but he's always been a very cautious person.
Absolutely.
And even if you were in recording sessions with him, he wouldn't talk to you at the beginning of the recording session. By the end of the recording session, he was treating you like his next buddy. But then once you went in the recording studio with him the next day, you started all over. And I'm saying this to say that whoever gave him that counterfeit pill was not a stranger.
It was someone he trusted dearly.
Dearly. Had to be.
And that's the sad irony of it. He trusted that individual dearly. and that individual knows that what they did caused his death.
Exactly.
Now, whether it was an accident or deliberate, I cannot say. I can say there were a lot of suspicious circumstances that make you wonder, was it intentional? Monies that were missing out of the vault, from what I've been told, inventory of gold bars that were supposed to be there that weren't there, a will that he had that consequently they say did not exist. Nobody knows anything about the will, yet his wife, former wife, Maite, acknowledged that there was a will and that the individual that was the prime suspect at one time for providing the pills knew the combination to the vault, and that's where the will was kept, in the vault. And then there was, again, members of Prince's own band who had stated that at one point he got upset with something that transpired with Larry Graham from Graham Central Station, who was touring with him at that time as a bass player, and they were collaborating in the studio, and he mentioned to his band members that he was upset with Larry Graham and he was going to take Larry Graham out of his will. Now, how are you going to take someone out of something that does not exist? So I'm telling you, there's a lot that is revealed in this film that's going on behind the scenes that people do not know, and it is not the narrative that the media has spent and that the sheriff's department let out to cover up their own blunders. As a matter of fact, Prince's brother told me out his mouth that the sheriff's department there messed up that investigation so badly he felt like he would never see justice in his brother's death because they know who did it, but they just messed up so badly. Now they don't have the ability to provide the tangible evidence that they could have had they operated properly from day one. And so this is a fan-funded movie. Prince's fans have made donations to my GoFundMe to help make this movie. We've raised about $30,000, which has been used very wisely. I've committed money from other places that I had to go to get financing. And right now we're about $37,000 away from what we need to complete the movie. So the GoFundMe is still up. And it's been up for a little while, but we're still working on this film. And hopefully some of even your listeners will go there to the GoFundMe and support this film so we can have it out by early next year, 2024, and make the world aware of what actually happened.
Now, they need to go to the site. They need to go to the site,
correct? Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. If they go to 421movie.com, and that's the numerical number 4, number 2, and number 1 movie.com, it will take them to the GoFundMe site. There is a trailer there of the intro for the movie so they can see how the movie starts out and background information on what we're doing, and an appeal to them to donate to help make this movie happen.
This is a story which needs to be told. Prince, very near to my friend Benjamin here, very near to me. This is a story that needs to be told. I'd like all of you to go out, 421movie.com, and help us finish and bring this documentary to daylight. It's a revealing story about the circumstances concerning his death. Ben, is there anything else you would like to say?
First, I just thank you for the wonderful opportunity to reminisce with you and share some of those things. I also want to just toss out there for anyone interested in knowing a little bit more about my Church of God in Christ story and the book that I wrote, which was called Prodigal Son, Child of the King. And a lot of people are very committed. That book was actually the inspiration, and I am as well. I am in particular because I know what transpired behind the scenes, but it was the inspiration for Oprah Winfrey's Greenleaf TV series.
Which was stolen from you.
at the time that I lived in San Diego and was representing Tone and Denise Matthews is when I wrote that book. And one of the people that I was also working with was a young singer, 16 years old. Her name was DeLeon Richards. DeLeon was the co-star of Oprah Winfrey's Brewster Place television series. She was also Oprah's goddaughter. And I told DeLeon's mother about the book that I had just completed and how I wanted to get on Oprah's TV show in Chicago, the Oprah Winfrey Show, to promote the book. I said, if she will add my book onto her book list, I'm sure I could sell a massive amount of copies. And Debbie Richards, DeLeon's mother, said, Ben, look, Dee is Oprah's goddaughter. She said, look, I'm going to give you her home address. Write her a nice letter. Tell her who you are. Give her a copy of the book. Let her know I gave you the address and told you to write her. And I did, and sent a copy of the book by Federal Express to her home at the Water Tower in Chicago. She got the letter. She got the book. A few weeks later, I got a letter back in San Diego at St. Stephen's Church, which was where I was working, and it was their account that I used to send the book to Oprah through Federal Express. It was their FedEx account. I got a letter there at the church office. They called me, sent word for me to come over to the church that I had a letter there from Oprah. And I came rushed over there. When I got there, the Bishop McKinney, Elder Julian Smith, Elder Norbert McDaniel, Teresa Flournoy, and several other members of the staff were all circled around for me to open up this letter, excited, thinking I'm about to go on the Oprah Winfrey Show. And I opened the letter. It was typed with a standard typewriter, not a computer, but the old school typewriters, and hand signed by Oprah. And she was telling me that she had read the book, how touching it was to her. And she went on to tell me, unfortunately, the man that took over the Church of God in Christ as the presiding bishop after my father died was her dear friend, Bishop Lewis H. Ford, there in Chicago. And that she knew if she brought me on the show to discuss the Church of God in Christ and what I was revealing in my book, that it would cause a problem for her with her friendship with Bishop Ford. So unfortunately, she would not be able to bring me on the show. And it was a big disappointment, but I took it with a grain of salt. Hey, that's life. You don't always get what you want. Fast forward around, what is it, 2017, 18, whatever it was, when Correct. Greenleaf first hits production, I get a call from Memphis from one of the members of Bishop C.H. Mason's family, which is my cousin through marriage. Bishop C.H. Mason, again, the founder of the Church of God in Christ. They're like, cuz, Oprah's down here in Memphis, and she's making this new TV show here. And I swear, everything that we've been doing on set is straight off the pages of your book.
Incredible.
I'm like, what?
Incredible.
They say, yeah, it's straight off the pages of your book. The show is called Greenleaf. Check it out. And I, in turn, did and reached out to a lawyer. They told me that I need to wait until the show airs and then document what's on the show and what actually came from my book. And I did that and got an attorney. They reached out to Oprah and her attorney. And basically, her attorney got back with mine and said, Ms. Winfrey does not know this man. She has never read his book. She knows nothing about it. And his book was not the inspiration for her show, Greenleaf. In fact, that she did not write the episodes of Greenleaf. They were written by someone else. And so then I asked my attorney, I said, can you put me in touch with the lawyer? Can you let me talk to him? So he did. He put me on a three-way with him. And the lawyer repeated the same thing to me and then added, and I'm a very expensive attorney. And if you choose to pursue with a lawsuit and you lose, you will be forced to pay my legal fees as well as your own legal fees with your lawyer. And so I listened to what he had to say courteously. And then I said, I thank you so much for your concern about my financial well-being. I said, but I have to tell you, first of all, if I file suit and I lose, I'm not concerned about your fees. I'll just add them into the bankruptcy that I'll file. And then I said, and logistically, your client has a bit of a problem. I said, because you say she doesn't know who I am and she's never read my book, but I have a Federal Express receipt showing that I sent the book to her home in Chicago. And I have a hand-signed letter from her telling me that she read the book and she was moved to tears. And the reason why she could not bring me on her show. I said, and furthermore, I used to represent her goddaughter who was a co-star of her Brewster Place TV series. So she's going to have a major problem explaining how she never read the book that I've got a letter saying that she read. And her attorney says, can you send me a copy of the letter? I said, absolutely. You can see the letter in the discovery when we file the lawsuit. And he said, wait a minute, let me talk to Ms. Winfrey again and we'll call you right back. And he got off the phone. He called back a little later and he said, I'm not saying she did read your book. I'm not saying she didn't read your book. I'm just saying she didn't write the episodes of the show. They were written by, I think the guy's name was Craig Wright from the TV series Lost. And even if she did read the book, her being inspired by the book to come up with her own ideas is not infringement or copyright, infringement of copyright. I said, she can't hide behind Craig Wright writing the episodes for the show because there's an interview in which she says that she sought out Craig Wright to write, to produce the show, and that she told him what she wanted the show to be about and what she wanted for some of the episodes. And that's documented in an interview. So she can't hide behind someone else created it because there's a clear interview where she says that she told him what to create. And what she told him to create, in my opinion, was based off of my book, which she had read back in 1993. And basically where it is right now is there. We're at limbo. I'm told that I don't necessarily have a statute of limitations because she's released it on DVD now. But there's some other intricacies that I can't really go into that are going on behind the scenes. But yeah, absolutely. That's another iron that's in the fire. Correct. And anybody that wants to know more about that can go to jopattersonministry.com. That's where the book is. That's where my story is. And you see the parallel there with Greenleaf. Again, that's jopattersonministry.com. Initial J, initial O, and Patterson Ministry.
Great story, great history, Ben. We're going to have to bring you back at another time. I'm happy, always happy to spend time with you, reminisce. And this was just a special experience for me. I wanted to get you in next. I waited a few weeks and I just, this was just your position. Your time was now. I thank all my listeners. Please go to 421movie.com and be a part.
421movie.com.
Yeah. Be a part of it. Yep. Be a part of this. Be a part of this. I'd also like to say to my African brothers and sisters out there, bring back the black family. Bring back the black family. Children need households. They need mothers and fathers, married mothers and fathers in the household. We lead in unwed mothers, broken homes by a substantial margin. And so I'm calling on men to do the right thing, to bring the American family back. Don't be a baby's daddy. Be a husband. Be a father. Because
that's right.
Responsibility without authority, slavery. Once again, why be a stepdad to someone else's child when you can be a husband and a father to your own child? Thank you. Have a great day.